When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me.
From the City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
2,500 years ago, Sun Tzu wrote history's most influential work on strategy. Now we have an expert where we will talk about strategy, the art of war, strategy against terror. His name is Gary Gagliardi. Back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Gary Gagliardi started studying Sun Tzu for over 30 years ago. Using the Art of War's principles, he went from success to success in business, finally building a multinational dollar high-tech software company from nothing. It was profitable every year that he ran it and twice appeared on Inc.'s 500 list of America's fastest-growing companies. Gary also won the Blue Chip Quality Award and was the Entrepreneur of the Year finalist. By working closely with America's largest companies, he saw their success and failure was easily explained by Sun Tzu's theory of competitive systems. After retiring from management, Gary focused his energies on making Sun Tzu's philosophy popular and promoting the study of competitive techniques in general. He has written numerous books on Sun Tzu and gives popular lectures on the secrets of competition. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Gary. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me, George.
Sure, my pleasure. A couple months ago, you talk about synchronicity. I picked up your book and I read it. And loved it. Couldn't put it down.
I have to ask which book. I have about a dozen of them out
there. The Art of War.
Oh, okay. Chinese Revealed? The
yes.
Chinese Revealed?
Strategy
okay.
Against Terror.
Oh, Strategy Against Terror.
And
okay.
About 2 weeks ago, my producer calls me up and says, hey, I found this person. He'd be a great guest. And she mentioned your book and said, I'll try to get you a copy right away. And I said, Lisa, I've already read it. Put him on. and here you are.
Well, there is a certain thing that works in the world, I think, that where things happen sort of naturally.
Yeah, no doubt about that. By the way, I've had some friends in St. Louis that they also pronounce theirs, spelled the same way as yours, Gagliardi's.
Right. Gagliardi is correct. That's okay. The Italian pronunciation. We go with Gagliardi on the radio because
it's easier,
you know,
for
people
most,
want to go to GaryGagliardi.com. It's GaglIardi. So people, have to know kind of how it's spelled.
Tell me your interest in Sun Tzu. How did this all happen?
Well, I started about, as you said, 30 years ago. I was an aimless college dropout at the time. I'd had four different jobs in 4 years. I was really kind of going nowhere, and somebody gave me a copy of Sun Tzu's The Art of War, and even in poor translation, and most of the translations out there are pretty bad, I saw that how it applied to my job in sales, and I started practicing its principles, not only in sailing, but in how I worked within my company. And I started getting promoted every 8 months with larger and larger companies. And within, about 7 years, I had my own software company, as you mentioned. And as we grew, I did my first adaptation, The Art of War plus The Art of Sales, for our sales guys. And we became one of the Inc. 500 fastest-growing companies in America and became very well-known in the high-tech business. And our customers, there were companies like AT&T and Motorola and GE, started asking me to speak about Sun Tzu's principles and how we used his philosophy in business and how we thought about strategy differently. Because all this is really the science of strategy. And though everybody knows the word strategy, very few people really know the techniques of strategy. And so I started giving presentations to large corporations, and they started buying the sales book. And when I sold my software company, I was as they say, financially independent,
mm-hmm.
and I could do anything I wanted, and companies were still paying me to travel all over the world to talk about Sun Tzu, and so I started getting more serious about the ancient Chinese and spent several years doing a new translation, working with the people at the University of Taiwan who'd done a new compilation of all. There were a lot of fragmentary manuscripts of Sun Tzu roaming around in China, and in Taiwan they put together a complete version from everything that was out there, and I did the English translation of that, and it won book awards, and it's all gone from there. Then I guess the real turning point was when I got cancer, and I decided that I wanted to teach everybody how they could use strategy in their lives, because I really saw that it saved my lives when fellow patients were literally dying because they didn't know how to make good life and death decisions because they hadn't been trained for it.
Well, good for you, and I'm glad. It seems like you've won the battle. Is that
it? Looks like it's a very fast cancer. It usually kills you within about 3 years if you don't cure it. Now it's been about 3.5 years now, so they tell me that I'm in good shape.
Good. Our prayers will stay with you on that. Who was this person, Sun Tzu?
Well, he was a general. I mean, he was known as a general of the time. He was part of what was called the landless nobility, what were called the Shi in China. This was a period in China where China consisted of like 500 warring city-states. It was about the same period of time that we think of the Greek city-states, where Athens was fighting against Sparta, was fighting against Thebes, and so on. And he went to work for the Kingdom of Wu, which was considered a semi-barbaric kingdom of the time, and the reason he got hired, because he wasn't known at the time, was because he wrote this book, The Art of War. And after that, Wu quickly became the dominant city-state in the period. And even though it was considered initially sort of on the fringes of Chinese society, it became the dominant period and stayed dominant for as long as he was alive. And then after his death, the knowledge, the manuscript, was kept alive, and actually it was his ancestor, Sun Ping, that popularized it again, and that led to Sun Ping worked for the Kingdom of Qin, which became China. The first emperor of China was the King of Qin, that used these principles to unite the kingdom. And its popularity in China really is one of the reasons that the Chinese Empire was really the longest lasting empire in the history of humanity.
Would you call him particularly brilliant, at least at the time?
No question about it. I mean, I compare him to somebody like Euclid, who wrote the first book of geometry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today, no matter how deeply you get into mathematics, you still start with Euclid's basic principles. And he had that kind of just sort of insight into how strategy works. And he laid out the basic principles in the same way that Euclid laid out, or any of the great Greek thinkers that we're familiar with, like Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, laid out the foundations of Western thought. He really was one of the architects of Eastern thought.
And you've been able to use this, of course, for everyday strategy, and we're going to talk about that and some of the predictions later on. But how about generals on this planet, military generals from all kinds of countries? Obviously, you would think that the Art of War was material that they needed to read in their war colleges.
Well, it's taught in all the war colleges. Our books are actually used in the war colleges. Our new book, The Warrior Class, which came out at the same time of Strategy Against Terror, is being sold in all the naval bases. And the people in military and people in the best business colleges are really the only people in America that understand the principles of strategy.
True, true. But it doesn't appear in some cases, when you look at what's going on in Iraq, are they actually using Sun Tzu strategy to take care of this situation?
Well, if you look at the way the war was fought, I mean, there's all kinds of situations that you go through. But if you look at the way the war was fought, it really was the most perfect war, according to Sun Tzu's philosophy. What Sun Tzu taught, and this was, remember, 2,500 years ago, he basically taught that information was more important than force. And that if you have the right information, you can conduct a war where you make the enemy surrender, that you don't have to kill people, and you don't have to have your own people killed, but if you apply information correctly, you can conquer a nation without literally fighting a single battle. That was his saying. He said that a general that fights 100 battles and wins 100 battles is not a great general. A great general is a general that finds a way to win without fighting a single battle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the war for Iraq, I mean, it was fought exactly along those lines. And if you sort of look what's happened in modern warfare since the beginning of the 20th century, you know, the the importance of information has really come alive during this era, and we see really that Sun Tzu's basic principles are proving out because we have the technology to do things that, you know, he couldn't have imagined at the time, but said that that was the basic thing. If you have the right information and you can deny that information to your opponent, you don't even have to fight him because he can't, you know, he can't defend himself.
And in many cases, we do see that happening now around this entire planet. But then you see the insurgencies happening. How does that equate to the art of war?
Well, you have to put that in context too. Once more, as I point out, basically the insurgency strategy is a hostage strategy. You know, one of the things we need is a good definition for what a terrorist is.
Right.
There are a lot of people around the world that say, oh, America's a terrorist because we kill people too. Well, terrorism isn't about killing people. What terrorism is about is basically leveraging the indifference for human life against the caring for human life. The terrorist strategy is basically, if we kill innocent people, we can get people who care about innocent people to do what we want. We can basically blackmail, and this is basically the same strategy that everybody that takes hostages has. He says, you know, I'm going to kill these innocent people if you don't do what I want. And that's what terrorists are. They're people that basically threaten innocent people if you don't do what they want. And with that definition, you can say who's a terrorist and who's not. With that definition, you can also say that there are terrorist states. I mean, if we look at the state of North Korea, the state of Iran, Iran is a very clear case. 70% of the people there don't want the government they have.
True. They'd prefer that we were in there helping.
Oh, absolutely.
Them.
Yeah. And don't think that's not going to happen one of these days. But the fact is that these leaders, these tyrants, basically hold their people hostage in order to get something out of other people. I mean, you know, what's happening in Sudan right now? I mean, the Arab leaders of Sudan are killing the black Africans there in the Darfur region. But, you know, they'd love for the America to come in and spend a lot of money, or the UN to come in, spend a lot of money, you know, support their country. You know, and for them, that would be a very good effect for killing people, you know. But that's basically the terrorist strategy. Now, when you look at that, that strategy has been around since forever. I mean, people have taken hostages since forever. Now, what defeats the hostage strategy? Well, basically not giving in to the threats. I mean, sometimes you're going to lose innocent people in the process, but if hostage takers don't get rewarded for the act, they'll stop doing it because, you know...
What's the purpose?
What's the purpose? What really happened that created modern terrorism, and you know this if you read Strategy Against Terror, was really a change in the way terrorism was reported. Prior to Vietnam, and let's go back to the beginning of the 20th century,
right.
A terrorist act was what started World War I, the killing of Archduke Ferdinand. The terrorists then were almost universally, they were completely, you know, derided in the press. The press was completely hostile. They made them out to be monsters. You know, people that did these kind of, you know, kidnappers, terrorists, people that acted like this were just, you know, portrayed as monsters. There was no sympathy for them. Well, if we go to the post-Vietnam era, what happened during Vietnam was that the media, the worldwide media, the mainstream media,
right,
really got a new script, and that script was David versus Goliath,
mm-hmm.
where the United States is Goliath. And by reduction, anybody that fights the United States must be David. And so because the terrorists, and actually the terrorists didn't realize this at first, it almost happened accidentally when they had the riot in Tehran and took over the embassy there in Iran during the Carter years. But the terrorists realized that if they did these things, they would get a kind of support in the media that really was denied to terrorists previously. It just really never happened before.
Good point.
And it was that support. What Sun Tzu teaches, there's. First of all, I should point out to your listeners that strategy is a science. It has a lot of components to it. It's anybody can master it, but you know, there's five keys to analyzing a strategic situation. There's four steps in advancing a situation, and so on. Any one of those keys to analyzing a situation is to discuss what the grounds, what the basis, the financial basis is for terror, for the battle. Because Sun Tzu teaches that every battle, in order to make sense, has to have an economic reason behind it,
mm-hmm.
because people have to have something to win. So the question is what did the terrorists win by, or how did the terrorists win by blowing up buildings in New York? Well, you know, how do they financially benefit from that? Well, basically, they get billions of dollars of free advertising.
Right.
That advertising basically translates into donations and recruits, and it financially supports their organization. And if you look at, you know, what the terrorists write about their organization, and especially if you look at the kind of announcements that Bin Laden puts out, it's very clearly a media campaign.
It's like a business, isn't it?
It's very much like a business. It's like, imagine for a moment, a thought experiment. If there was a Blue Jeans company, and the Blue Jeans company hired a serial killer to go out to kill people and leave their blue jeans at the site to promote their brand. Now, you have to ask yourself, would the media, if that was happening, would the media, you know, wait for videos from the serial killer, you know, advertising the blue jeans? Would they promote those people as reasonable and, you know, that were doing something that was, you know, made sense, you know, and how, you know, how they were, you know, finding a great way to break through the monopoly of the blue jeans by, you know, the blue jean marketplace that had been dominated too long by these large companies that make blue jeans. I mean, the media would never do that, I hope.
I hope. Yeah, don't say never.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at hip-hop music, I guess you've got to almost question that. But I mean, basically that's what's happening with terrorism. Terrorism is using these horrendous acts of killing innocent people to get free advertising, and that translates into money and donations for them. And if you really look at the history of terror, you know, terrorism basically peaked after 9/11. It peaked in the sense of financial support and public support. Surveys after 9/11 basically showed that Osama bin Laden was approved of by about 95% of the people in Saudi Arabia, which is where the survey happened to be taken. Today, those after we went to war against terrorism, those numbers are down below 25%. So for those that, you know, think that not responding to terror is the way to go, well, they're very wrong. Just like those people that say that the cause of terror is American capitalism and imperialism and stuff like that. You know, it just, if you just compare it to the simple rules of strategy, none of those arguments hold up, because you have a framework where you can analyze those kinds of statements and say, okay, if that was true, then this would also be true. You know, and strategy gives you that whole host of tools where you can really put these things into a larger context and understand what's really happening behind the scenes. And of course, you've got to do the research. I mean, this country, and especially the mainstream media, has a serious problem, you know, digging in to find out how the terrorists are thinking and what they're thinking and reading their literature. I mean, we found their training handbooks and things like that, and yet that information never gets out in the press for one reason, and that's because it doesn't support the only story the press is interested in telling, which is this David versus Goliath story. It tells different story.
That is so true. Are you happy or satisfied with the direction of our strategy as we're trying to fight this beast?
It has very good aspects, and it has very bad aspects. Certainly the ground war in Afghanistan and Iraq was a very good thing. If you look, what strategy, and for your readers, actually my purpose of promoting this stuff is to teach people strategy, so let me back up here. What Sun Tzu teaches is that our natural reactions to threats, which are flight or fight, that is running away or getting into conflicts with people, are basically what animals do, that human beings can work longer term. And he says, instead of thinking about, gee, should I run away or should I fight, what do I want to accomplish longer term? And he brings it all down to a positioning. And he says, don't worry about fighting, running away, that kind of stuff. Worry about your position and work to advance your position in such a way that people can't attack you, and over time people want to join you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, and so you draw position maps, and Sun Tzu has these systems for analyzing position and so on. I mean, the five key elements, the one I mentioned was already ground, the other was ground, climate, philosophy, leadership, and methods. And we've talked a little bit about methods, which is the methods of the terrorist, the hostage taking. Basically, that tells you the ground you've got to fight on. Now, certainly, there's a ground war here, and if you drew a map of the Middle East, because this is a war against Islamic terror, it's something historically, if you look at the philosophy of Islamic terror, it goes back to literally 25 years after Muhammad died, all the way back in the 7th century was the foundation of it. The Qajarites were the first Islamic fundamentalists, and they ended up killing the fourth caliph and of of Islam. And mm-hmm. what the fundamentalists say they want to do is to bring back the caliphate, that is the one leader. But if you look at the history of fundamentalism, they actually killed off the last of the caliphs. So, but anyway, before we get sidetracked, the idea is to advance a position, build up a position, advance a position. If you looked at the position of the Middle East before Iraq and Afghanistan, you had a whole wealth of nations. Actually, on my website, which is booksonstrategy.com, people can go there and they can actually see the map. Before we went there into Afghanistan, you had a whole bunch of countries that were supporting terrorism and doing research into weapons of mass destruction.
Hold that thought right there, Gary. We'll take this quick break. We'll be right back with you. Another website. We've got two of them linked. Lex, why don't you get the other one up too, booksonstrategy.com. We'll be back in a moment right here on coasttocoastam.com.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Indeed. We're going to be talking with Gary Gagliardi later about some of his predictions as this relates to The Art of War, Sun Tzu. Some of them are pretty fascinating. The rest of them will have you just go, I didn't know that. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Gary Gagliardi. Gary, you think when Sun Tzu was putting together his Art of War that he saw the future and that was how many applications this theory could be presented to?
Well, he wrote the book at a very high level abstraction. In other words, when you read The Art of War, you won't know what kind of weapons they used in ancient China. You won't know if they had cavalry or they fought in chariots, because he never mentions the techniques, the specific techniques that were used at the time. Unlike, well, if you read warfare, various strategists that have been down through history, they deal mostly with techniques. If you read Clausewitz, for example, you know, it's all about the use of cannon. But what made Sun Tzu different is he realized that the most important weapon was the human mind. And he also realized that competition wasn't just something that takes place in the battlefield. but it's something that happens throughout life. And he talks about, I mean, he talks a lot about organizations and how you deal with organizations and how you deal with, you know, as a general, governments that are above you and have different views and different goals than you have out in the field. And, you know, he just saw the way that competition worked and how people reacted, and he tried to write it in a way that it would apply to literally anything. You know, it's like, well, once more, I go back to Euclid's geometry. You know, Euclid, you know, may have written the book initially because he wanted to build houses or temples or whatever, but the basic science was done in such a high level of abstraction that it can be used for anything. And in Sun Tzu's case, it can be used in anything that basically takes place in a competitive environment, something where you have, well, an environment where you're dealing with other people and you have to make decisions and you have to understand what your position is and you have to understand about how you advance your position. And that's the big key to what he talks about, is that it's not about fighting people, it's not about winning battles, it's about continually looking for ways to advance your position.
Right.
And he has, you know, a number of rules. I mean, you know, we know some of them sort of by, you know, osmosis, the idea that speed is the essence of war, or the idea that the best offense, the best defense is a good offense. I mean, a lot of this, of course, we've gotten from sports, but these lessons were, in many sense, timeless. I mean, he said in his book over and over again, is everybody tries to use the art of war, which is just another way of saying strategy.
Don't you think some football coaches, if they use this kind of strategy, could probably win more games?
I'm sure that they could. As a matter of fact, that's one of the most requested titles we get, is to do one for the art of coaching. One of my, actually my second cousin, John Gagliardi, is the winningest college football coach of all time, and we're actually discussing maybe doing a book together.
That's great.
Based around the art of war.
The fighters at the Alamo, had they really studied Sun Tzu, might they have had a better outcome?
Well, they weren't going to win in the sense of survive the battle. There are situations, that's what Sun Tzu, you know, one of the things he describes is the various situations that you can be in. He breaks it down into 9 different situations and what you have to do in those situations. And they kind of go from the beginning of a campaign till the end of the campaign, and the last stage is the desperate situation. And basically all you can do in that situation is fight and die.
Which is what they did.
Which is exactly what they did. But if you do that correctly, as they did at the Alamo, that can enable you to win the war. And it's that powerful, what Sun Tzu teaches, and it's probably one of the most important lessons, is that he teaches that strength doesn't come from size or money or power in the normal sense. What strength comes from is unity, and unity is based upon philosophy. And that the good organizations are the ones that have a clear philosophy that unites them. And there's a story I tell in my seminars, which reminds me, if anybody's in Boise, we have a seminar coming up in Boise at the end of middle of next week.
Lots of listeners in Boise.
Okay, good. Good. If they're interested, they can go to our website, and they can go to your website to get to our website. And we're giving, I think, 3 or 4 seminars over the 26th and 27th. But anyway, one of the stories I tell in my seminar is how there's 3 levels of philosophy people can have. You know, the story I tell is a man's walking down the road and he sees 3 people working and he doesn't understand what they're doing. And he asks the first one, "What are you doing?" And he says, I'm earning a decent day's wage for a decent day's work. But that doesn't tell the man anything. So he asks the next man what you're doing. He says, "I'm trying to become the best stonemason I can." And he says, "Oh, you're cutting stones." He saw him pounding on stones. He didn't understand what they're doing. "Okay, you're becoming a stonemason." Okay. And then he asks the third man, "Well, what are you doing though?" And he says, "I'm building a cathedral. I'm building something that'll be here thousands of years after I'm gone, something that my children and my grandchildren can look up to and see that their ancestor was part of that." And philosophy has all 3 of those things, and Sun Tzu talks about that. The first level is, you know, the organization, the competitive whatever, has to be able to support itself to survive. That's the economic foundation, the ground is what Sun Tzu calls it. The second level is professionalism, what Sun Tzu calls methods, and you have to know, you have to have the skills to do things. But what holds that together, the most important element, is that philosophy in the middle, because that's what unites people and makes them willing to sacrifice their lives because it's something they believe in. And it's one of the reasons that freedom has been such a powerful force changing the world, is that something people are willing to die for and have been willing to die for throughout American history.
Let's equate this for a moment to the suicide bombers, these young men and women who are blowing themselves up in Israel, on the Gaza Strip, who are killing themselves in Iraq, who are blowing themselves up at the near military barracks. Where is the philosophy behind that for them?
Well, you have to realize what the situation is for young men in that part of the world. You're talking about a part of the world that has virtually no political freedom, has no economic freedom. People have nothing to do with their lives to a large part.
No upside right now.
Yeah, and there's been a survey taken, actually it was done by the Gallup organization, and they discovered that 50% of the people, young men in the Middle East, men under 30, want to emigrate, move to other countries. Can you imagine if 50% of the men in America, you know, the working age man just coming into to work, wanted to leave the country?
Yeah. And millions, yeah.
That tells you what their situation is like how desperate it is. It's only natural that some of them would turn to organizations that can give their lives some kind of meaning, because their lives don't have any meaning. The old organizations in that part of the world, the clans and those kinds of organizations, are being actually destroyed or have been destroyed over the last, we'll say, 100 years, basically by the statism, by the nationalism, by the strongmen that have come in and taken over these countries and basically destroyed the old clan organizations with their own, you know, centralized governments. And because there's very little economic freedom, virtually no economic freedom in that part of the world, people just don't have anything meaningful to do with their lives. But the terrorists, of course, are kind of duping these young men. They use religion. And if you read their training manuals, you know, the vast majority of terrorists aren't people that are willing to sacrifice their lives.
Exactly. I mean, you don't see Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri and all those other clowns doing this.
What they do is they get a hold of young, impressionable men, just like any cult would do it, you know, and they brainwash these people to kill themselves. But the leaders and the entire structure, if you read the, you know, anybody that's really part of the organization, I thought the funniest thing in reading the Al-Qaeda training manual, I thought the funniest thing was that the organizations they mentioned in the beginning of their training manual is the organizations that they thought were their competition. Of course, when you're sensitive to strategy, you're always thinking who your competition is. They talk about the Masons, the Rotary Club, and organizations like that, literally, as about, you know, the organizations that they want to get people away from.
That's something.
Yeah, you'd never think that.
No.
But it's because those kinds of organizations give people a place in the world. You know, they give their lives some meaning. And the manual says a lot of other interesting stuff, like, you know, they don't say, you know, go to the mosque to recruit people, because, you know, the framework of the organization isn't people that are particularly religious. They actually said number one on their list of people that they should recruit are people like smugglers, because when you get down to the techniques of terrorism, it's really all about, you know, a path to power for people.
Exactly.
You know, these people have been denied a path to power, and they're looking for ways to get both money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, another thing in the manuals that's very clear is that where you want to rise to in the organization is where you're trusted with money, where you can get the donations and use them to support yourself and so on, what they call their commanders, because that, you know, you have to prove yourself before you can get to that level. So it's a, you know, it makes perfect sense when they're in that part of the world. But then again, we're doing exactly the right thing. What we have to do is spread democracy and freedom to that part of the world. You know, there has been a period of time here, say for the last 50 or 60 years, where we thought communism was the main threat, and we really didn't worry about these parts of the world that were, you know, had no more freedom, economic freedom, than communism allowed. But because, you know, it wasn't clear that these people also wanted to, you know, had programs of world domination, they didn't seem like a threat. But now that there is no more communism, it's clear that these people now represent a threat. But just like, you know, communism, if you can bring freedom to that part of the world, it's not whole philosophy doesn't have that much appeal. That's what they'll, you know, I talked earlier about how people always say, well, it's capitalism, it's America that's causing these problems. And what I like to point out is that there is an inverse relationship between American involvement in a part of the world and the amount of terrorism there. In other words, the less America is involved, the less American businesses there, the less American interests or companies or we'll just say Western, because it doesn't have to be America, the more likely there is to be terrorism. And people don't realize that because the information goes through the news media, which, you know, has their own story to tell. But the most terrorist deaths have actually been in Algeria. Over the last 20 years, there have been about 150,000 deaths in Algeria fighting fundamentalist terror.
My God.
And actually, the Algerians have done a brilliant job fighting terror. They kind of woke up. They initially tried to placate the terrorists, and it worked just like everything works when you try and placate hostage takers. It works as well as when you pay off hostage takers down in Latin America. You get a booming business of hostage takers. Well, the same thing happened in Algeria, which is why the organization got so big, is because the powers that be there, the central government, initially tried to placate the terrorists. And it got so bad that there were days where there were so many terrorist attacks that 800 people were killed in one night by terrorist attacks across the country. And what the Algerians started doing, they did a number of things, mm-hmm. and they're in the back of the book, Strategy Against Terror, if people are interested. But the thing that really worked was they started holding elections, and they started making it clear that they were going to give power to the people, that people could have a democratic representation, the clans that had power weren't going to hold on to power. They started liberalizing the economy. They started allowing economic freedom. They started turning the whole system around. And after that, terrorism just died off. And it's one of the real success stories against terrorism. And it's a success story nobody hears. And when you see what our government's doing, is they're basically trying to copy what was done in Algeria and what was also done, in Peru, where they weren't fighting Islamic terrorists, but it was the Shining Path and something very similar.
Why does it seem, though, that we, along with the Brits, seem to be going at it alone here?
Well, let me see. What happened in World War II? Who was it that ended up defeating Hitler?
It was us.
Did the Scandinavian countries rush to the aid of?
Nope.
It's the same old story.
Is it our destiny, Gary? Is that what it is? Is it our destiny to do this?
I think that there are countries. I think there are a few countries that really believe in freedom, and really believe in the transforming power of freedom. And it's not my job to say whose destiny it is, but once more, it goes back to Sun Tzu's basic philosophy, system of what's a strategic position made out of. Well, our strategic position in America, we were founded on freedom. If we don't stand for freedom, political freedom, economic freedom, we don't stand for anything. And we believe freedom's right for us, and by extension, we believe it's right for the world. And the reason and the fact that we believe that is why the world isn't enslaved today. I mean, if we didn't believe that, we wouldn't have fought Hitler. Hitler would control all of Europe today. We wouldn't have fought communism. We wouldn't have fought the Japanese in Asia. We wouldn't have cared about any of that. But we do care desperately about freedom. We think it's worth fighting for.
What about economic gain as well? There's no question that a freer Iraq will benefit us in terms of oil. In our ability, I think, to tap into that. Does that play a part in any of this?
Well, economics is always the foundation, and there's no doubt in my mind that a economically free Middle East will be more productive, and there'll be customers for our products, and we'll be able to buy products from them, just like we do from Asia and Europe, and that whole zone of the developing world. China and India now are huge development partners, in the world, more important in many respects than Europe. But to say that this was a war about oil is silly. The fact is, as facts have revealed, it would have been very easy for the United States to get all the cheap oil they wanted from Saddam if we just agreed to allow him to, remove sanctions and the rest of it. I mean, look at the UN. They tapped into a bonanza there. There's also a little bit of confusion of people about who buys Middle Eastern oil. Only about 5% of the United States oil comes from the Middle East. Our oil comes from basically Mexico and Canada and places in the Western Hemisphere, mm-hmm. because of the transportation costs.
Right.
It all goes into the same thing. I mean, if there's a tight supply of oil, the prices go up everywhere.
Sure.
It's a fungible commodity. But the the idea that we fought the war for oil is just silly, because we could have got all the oil. I mean, it's like Iran. You know, we can deal with Iran if we didn't particularly care about, you know, the people there that are being oppressed by the mullahs. And, you know, we can get all the oil we want if we sell them the weapons they want and, you know, play their, you know, if we basically submit to the whole hostage mentality, if we pay the bribe, you know, we'll get whatever we want, because all they want is power, and if we play the game, they'll play along with us. I mean, look at the UN. You know, the UN made little. I mean, the individuals in the UN.
And we haven't heard the end of that one either.
Oh no, but it shows you where the money was. I mean, Saddam was passing out billions and billions of dollars because he was willing to do it. If anybody thinks that we'll get oil cheaper from Iraq, which will be part of the free market, and they won't be able to control the prices because the prices will be controlled by the market, than we could have got from Saddam, whose price was whatever he said it was, just doesn't know anything about economics. And at this point, I should say, basically, strategy combines the science of mathematics, economics, and human psychology. And if you, you know, sort of, you know, don't understand how economics work, it's hard to understand how strategy works.
What about the greed factor of some that probably would capitalize on everything that happens? That's real. That's there.
Actually, that's what Sun Tzu says about everybody. Everybody says that the prime motivations for everybody is basically to make money and have a good life. You know, I mean, that's what motivates us all. The only thing that really is different is the philosophy we have about how that's done. In other words, in America, we have a philosophy that the way that's done is through freedom and voluntary relationships. You know, when we go to the store to buy something, that's something we choose to do. Nobody forces us to do it. In other parts of the world, they think that the way that you get wealthy is basically hold a gun to somebody's head and take it away from them. If you look at the governments in the Middle East, they're basically all kleptocracies. The reason there's no economic freedom is because if you're making any money, the people in the government will find a way to take it from you. I mean, there's some countries in that region where they figure that every dollar that's made by a small business is taxed about 129%. So, I mean, there's no incentive to go into business. It's, you know, it's just horrifying. And that's why things that are really important in this war, things like, you know, indicators of economic freedom. I mean, that's, you know, getting the government, you know, in the United States, we worry about the government being on our back. But, you know, at least the government takes the money and tries to provide services with it. You know, I mean, there is, and that's actually something that's really happening now in the Middle East for the first time, is they're talking about these ideas of governments doing, instead of ruling people, providing services, being service organizations, governments having transparency so you can see what they're doing with their money, and they aren't just there to make the people in power rich. You know, you know the whole idea is there's no reason to elect people if all the elected people are going to do is, you know, be the new bloodsuckers. So, you know, they're beginning to debate all these things right now and beginning to understand how democracy works, where it's not people taking from one another. The way that you make money is by satisfying the needs of other people so that they'll give you their money voluntarily.
Gary, stay with us. We'll be back with you a couple more hours. We'll talk about everyday strategies of Sun Tzu's Art of War, how that will equate to how we live. And then I do want to get into your predictions next hour as well. Final hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Gary Gagliardi. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.